This podcast is brought to you by Learn Prime. Hone your development skills at learn.thoughtbot.com.
Giant robot smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. My name is Ben Orenstein, and I'm here today with Chaz Emmerich. Hey, Chaz.
How you doing?
Good. So I read on your blog, you wrote a blog post about 100% time.
Sure.
Where you say you now have complete freedom over deciding what you're going to do with your time. And I'm curious how you spend it now, given that.
So I guess I should have reread all the past year's worth of blog posts.
I'm gonna throw them back at you.
Right.
Yep.
And so I talked about this in some length on the Relevance podcast, now the Cognicast, some months ago. Mm-hmm. Thinking back to it, so the basic premise is that I sort of accidentally put myself into a position where, like you say, I have the sort of economic circumstances where I have far more freedom and sort of agency in what I do mm-hmm. on a day-to-day basis, and also sort of more strategically, so to speak, in terms of, you know, what sort of categories of activities, or, you know, more professionally, what sorts of projects I take on and that thing, and mm-hmm. and that sort of thing, as opposed to sort of being at the behest of clients or customers necessarily on sort of a day-to-day kind of cadence.
Mm-hmm.
Like in no way am I retired at all. I'm actually a bit of a workaholic, and that's a tendency that the whole 100% time post was sort of part of me working through dealing with that.
Mm.
Just because I really had been a workaholic to an extent that was very detrimental to me personally and mm. also professionally. And so over the years where I sort of got myself into a position where that didn't need to be the case, it's sort of a process of realization of that and trying to figure out what that means for life. You know, when you don't feel like you need to be under the gun constantly,
mm-hmm.
what do you do with, you know, it's called slack time now, but, you know, some years before it was just slacking off.
Mm.
And so I think there's something in the zeitgeist where there's slack time isn't slacking off necessarily. It's room to do big think, perhaps, or otherwise recharge, or, you know, think outside the box, whatever, mm-hmm. Whatever sort of bubblegum phrase you want to put on it. But it is a very good thing to have that kind of freedom. So in terms of what I'm working on, I mean, I do a lot of open source work in the Clojure area specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the 100% time, although I don't think I realized it at the time, was writing the book for O'Reilly on Clojure.
Mm-hmm.
And since that finished, I've been working on really largely one project, which you're going to scoop something now.
Nice.
Because I haven't talked publicly about it yet, and I'm not talking a lot about it, but at quilt.org. Like the blanket quilt.org
mm-hmm.
Is sort of the homepage or the nascent homepage for what I'm working on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing there yet except like a blank to put in your email address. But it's something I've been working on in one shape or another for about 2 years. And it's really a way to sort of a recharacterization of how to organize data really in a very broad way, not just within a particular application or for a particular language or a particular company, but hopefully a holistic approach to how we organize, query, and compute over data on a worldwide scale, we hope.
Hmm.
Which makes me sound like a ridiculous egomaniac, but that's sort of the nature of these things.
Hmm. So can you give me a little more detail or like a use case or?
Yeah. So this is actually something I'm going to be talking about a little bit at the Philly ETE conference next week.
Mm-hmm.
Not Quilt itself, but sort of some of the difficulties and sort of discomfort that I've had with how we do data and computation.
Hmm.
And so the focus of that talk is about what the notion of quote-unquote an API looks like within a world of distributed systems. You know, the modern notion of an API is this sort of very point-to-point synchronous communication between two discrete processes that are exchanging data that they can each either produce or parse. And it's a very fragile and a very unscalable and undistributed mode of communication and computation.
Mm.
And it's a very stark contrast when juxtaposed with what the world is becoming more and more, which is these very diverse sort of diaspora of distributed systems where, you know, you have companies running systems that work with data that need to interoperate with other companies that have similar but different data, and individuals that have their own stores of that data that they either need to collaborate with these companies in order to share, say, healthcare records from, you know, a provider to another provider to your own archive to et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of there's a disconnect there in terms of what the modern notion of an API is and the things that we want to accomplish in the world beyond you talking to me, and that's sort of the end of the conversation. There's always multiple parties involved, and there's always sort of a sloppiness in the data and the schemas that represent how that data is represented.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'll be talking about in the talk, and Quilt in part is aiming to provide some characterization of a way to sort of get over that disconnect.
Hmm. So is Quilt a service, or is it a tool? Is it a... Do you know yet?
Yes, to all those. So everything that I've been building is going to be open sourced. And then there's some various ways in which I'm going to offer some commercial services around it.
Mm-hmm.
But everything that I've been working on and that will be associated with that quilt.org site will be open sourced. And you can run your own quilt services locally and that sort of thing if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody will be able to play with it eventually.
Okay, cool. So stay tuned for that.
Right.
Cool. Maybe we could talk a little bit about how you got to the point where you're able to focus on these fun big projects, like a little bit of that history and sort of PDF, your PDF thing.
The PDF thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wrote it down. PDF tech stream.
Right. Snowtide.com for all of your PDF extraction needs.
Mm-hmm.
God, this is ancient history now. So the company's name is Snowtide, very badly named, but I came up with it almost exactly 15 years ago.
Mm.
Founded the company in 2000. Failed with a totally unrelated product. Ended up with something like $140,000 in debt because I was bootstrapping and did it badly.
Okay.
Credit
card debt then or something?
Yeah. So I put myself through college in large part by selling stuff on eBay, in particular FireWire drives. I don't know if you remember those things.
Barely.
Yeah. So this was, we're now going back like 17, 18 years,
mm-hmm.
Where I was, I would buy all the parts, including an enclosure
mm-hmm.
and an internal IDE drive. I would put them together and sell them as a FireWire drive on eBay.
Okay.
And there were no companies making things that were labeled as FireWire drives at the time. So the percentage margins were fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual revenue numbers were paltry, but were pretty good for a college kid just paying the bills.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, through that process, I bootstrapped that business up through credit cards. And so I had $50,000 or $60,000 in float at any point in time on credit cards. But because of the way payment grace periods worked and things like that, I never paid any interest. And basically, you know, Chase and Citibank ended up financing my little eBay business, which,
yep.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I had, for better or worse, I had access to a pretty sizable credit line when I was done with that business, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I live in Western Massachusetts. There's no such thing as venture capital and all that sort of stuff out here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 15 years ago, I was 15 years younger in terms of my business sense and what I was looking to build to begin with, never mind the sale size of things. So the first iteration of Snowtide failed badly,
mm-hmm.
and along with that $140,000. So then I went back to, not back to, I had to go get a job. So I worked for about 2 or 2.5 years, paid off the debt, and sort of reformulated some way to get out of that circumstance because, you know, working where I was wasn't really working out for me. It was an insurance company. It was
mm-hmm.
a fairly staid culture, not very technically forward-looking. It didn't really push my buttons in all the various ways.
And did you want to get out of that because of what that particular thing was, or were you more generally like, I really want to run my own business, I want to do my own thing?
Yeah, I mean, I've had two jobs. Well, yeah, two jobs where I was actually the employee in my life.
Mm-hmm.
This one with the insurance company, and then for about 3 months, when I was a sophomore in high school, I worked at a little local computer shop, like putting together Apple Talk networks or something.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, all the money I've ever made in my life has always been through either little companies I've started or, you know, maybe small to moderate sized companies that I've started since then.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad had his own business. He was a mechanic, but he started a local business where he would go to your house and work on your, or your place of business and work on your car instead of you driving somewhere and bringing it. So that was sort of my role model in terms of here's a different way of working as opposed to like you go somewhere, you clock in, you do your work and you clock out.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of a formational thing.
Mm-hmm.
Working for other people has never really appealed to me. I forget who wrote it, but I think it might have been the CD Baby guy. You have to decide whether you're going to be rich or you're going to be king. In terms of when you start a company, you can either, you know, seek financing, and in general, you will have the resources available to scale whatever business you're in to a level far beyond if it was just you starting it on your own from a financial standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll likely have less of the outcome. That's the sort of rich path. And the king path is where you or some small set of partners without outside financing, you retain 100% of the proceeds and the interest in the business concern. And so you end up with a smaller outcome total or smaller potential outcome, but you have total control of the business.
Yep.
To date, I've always sort of tilted towards the latter, where I very much like having that sort of self-determination aspect to things. So yeah, I was working at this insurance company and the people were great. I mean, in terms of, you know, big company jobs, it was fantastic, but I definitely wanted to have my own is roughly the simplest, best way to put it.
Yeah. You wanted to be king.
Right. Some of the work on the failed project from a couple of years prior included trying to get content out of PDF documents. And, you know, I sort of very personally felt the need for something like that in the Java space, which is where I was operating. There wasn't anything useful or practical. And so I sort of extracted that piece from the prior project and sort of built it out into something more substantial.
Mm-hmm.
10, 12 years later, presently it's got many hundreds of customers and processes many billions of documents yearly, does very well for them and very well for me.
Mm. So do you run this as a service or is this something that I downloaded and works?
No, it's a very traditional software sales model. So you get a perpetual license to run it on one server. It's a per server licensing model.
Mm-hmm.
And then a yearly support and maintenance component to get updates and more timely support responses, et cetera.
Yep.
That model grew out of when I started that product line. So like, you know, 2004, that's the way software was sold.
Yeah, totally.
And actually, it still very much matches up with the expectations of the sort of core customer base, which is large enterprises doing publishing, involved in finance, government, et cetera, where, you know, they have a particular application or maybe an outward-facing product, and they are going to allocate end machines to run this thing on because they know how much load they're going to be putting on the thing. They have all these other things that are associated with the application in terms of databases and compute power and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they know how many machines they need and they come to me with an order.
Huh. So with your tool, PDFs come in and out comes data?
So with all this time and I haven't actually given the pitch on the product. Mm-hmm. So PDF TextStream is a library for extracting content very broadly writ from PDF documents, including text, metadata, form data, annotations, attachments, etc. It used to be just text, which is where the name came from, but mm-hmm. customer demand being what it is, you sort of start adding more and more things. And so it's at version 2.7 right now. For version 3, a image extraction component is going to be added, and that's sort of the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of it being this single monolithic product. So starting with version 3, it's going to be you buy into this very minimal base that will be fairly inexpensive and then add form extraction, add text extraction, add the image capability sort of as add-ins or features.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of better aligns with user usage as well. So they'll bring a little sanity to the naming of the product as well as also sort of positioning it within the market.
Gotcha. This product exists because people get data in a format that they don't actually want it. They want it in a different format.
Well, so
it's like fundamentally glue, right? Glue for a, yeah. It almost, or not, like it's like a balm for a problem, right? Like if they could just get JSON or something, right? Then
this thing disappears. So, I mean, this is, I mean, here's where worlds start colliding, right? So, so what I was talking before about how Quill is aiming to address this world where you have multiple parties dealing with data that either has no schema or sort of a messy, heterogeneous schema that is shared by many people in a distributed way. Mm-hmm. You know, the only reason why PDF TextStream exists is because you have, you know, company A has invoices and they're sending it out to companies, you know, A through Z, right? Mm-hmm. And all those different companies need to take that invoice in, somehow percolate it through whatever internal process they have to land it into their, you know, master purchasing database that they can go do actual work with.
Right.
And so that entire like ingestion process is fundamentally waste, right?
Right.
It's not contributing at all to the
friction.
Advancement. Right. Yeah. It's not contributing at all to the advancement of the business objectives or bettering life for any of the employees or customers or anybody involved in the process. It's purely incidental complexity
right.
that derives from this sort of impedance mismatch between you communicating with me, communicating with and other people over this pool of very messily defined data, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, PDF TextStream is sort of, it improves on that process sort of incrementally by giving people, so PDFs are a horrible format for interchange of data.
Mm-hmm.
There's no structure at all. It's worse than HTML in terms of actually providing some kind of semantic structure to the data. It's more like each page is a graphics context, basically a JavaScript canvas
mm-hmm.
onto which the PDF instructions write a character at a time. And so you can imagine deriving some structure out of that, which PDF TextStream does. It's roughly like a OCR process, optical character recognition, without the character recognition. Because we already have the character,
mm-hmm.
but we have no notion of word, line, paragraph, column, table, etc.
Right.
So there's other open source libraries that will just give you a dump of all the characters that are encoded,
yep.
but the characters can be encoded out of order from what the natural reading order is within the document, just because of the implementation details of the library that produced the PDF to begin with.
Wow. Weird.
Yeah. So I mean, PDF is derived from PostScript, which is the language that's used to send pages to printers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing in PostScript that says you have to output a page top to bottom, left to right. And certainly if you're talking about a world where you have both left to right languages as well as things like Arabic and Hebrew and Urdu, et cetera, that go right to left, and even languages that go that have a vertical orientation like Chinese, Japanese, and Korean can, you know, there's no hard and fixed rules about the order in which characters need to be put out to a page.
Mm-hmm.
And so PDF TextStream sort of normalizes all that and presents this direct API to the end user where it's like, give me the text, make it in the order that you expect to appear in, then you have a string, and then you walk off with it wherever you need to.
Yeah.
As opposed to other libraries where it's just like, here's a dump of all the character codes that occur within the page. And there's other utilities that make things easier, like just give me the text and where this bounding box is, which is good for automating form extraction, that kind of thing.
So if Quilt is very successful, will it hopefully kill your older business?
Yes. Yes. Although the connection between the two is extremely tenuous
mm-hmm.
that I sort of just came up with off the top of my head just now. But it's true that it's if it ends up exceeding all my wildest dreams, then you would be able to exchange Quilt data without any of that ingestion process. You wouldn't have to convert it over to a local representation, that sort of thing, just because Quilt's natural representation is rich enough to express certainly everything I've seen in the PDF world, for example.
Hmm. Does that business, the PDF TextStream, does it run pretty much on its own? Do you spend a lot of time on it?
It sort of comes and goes in spurts. So there's definitely inquiries and problems that customers have, and those get answered very sort of immediately. I'm very big in providing very rapid and quality customer support.
Mm-hmm.
That's a key differentiator actually within the market that it's in, because enterprise software vendors generally are horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And so if my customers are generally used to that, and I can provide rapid responses that are potentially deeply technical and, you know, get them in and out of this problem that they wish they didn't have in the first place as fast as possible, then that's to my benefit, obviously.
For sure.
So in that way, the 100% time post kind of overstates it a little bit, because mm-hmm. there are, you know, customer has a problem. I'm not just going to say, well, I feel like going hiking today.
Yeah.
So forget mm-hmm. about that. I'm, you know, definitely going to be on it and tackling whatever bug there is, and maybe it's going to require some research or whatever, in which case it may take a day or it may take 3 days, but again, that's still outpacing their expectations. And because it's not a service oriented business, I'm not on a pager and that sort of thing.
Yep.
So I mean, it's a sizable amount of time, but it's by no means what I do all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I have other people that help with various other aspects of the business, including nailing down sort of run of the mill bugs and issues that come along. That's just sort of good business to make it so that the more mundane questions can be answered by somebody else. But if there's a novel issue or something that's sort of highly technical, then I definitely pick it up and do what's necessary.
Gotcha. Let's talk a little bit about Clojure.
Sure.
Yeah. So you authored a book called Programming Clojure for O'Reilly.
Mm-mm-mm.
No, you didn't. Clojure Programming.
There you go.
Clojure Programming. There it is.
The one with the bird on it. Oh, yes. They both have birds on it, actually.
Do they?
They do. Programming Clojure has a, not a swan. Oh, maybe it is a swan. Ours has a painted snipe.
A painted snipe. A snipe is a real thing?
A painted snipe is a real thing. It's like a watershed bird. You know, the little birds that run through the breaking waves.
Oh, okay.
Huh. The surf, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, the O'Reilly book is...
The O'Reilly book is you.
Is the one. You can't really miss the O'Reilly covers.
No, definitely
they've
not.
They've done a good job on that marketing.
Mm-hmm.
So I co-wrote it with Brian Carper and Christoph Grand. It's done reasonably well as far as technical books go. I don't really have any frame of reference, but
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's done reasonably well. Mm-hmm. People seem to like it enough.
Yeah. Are you planning another edition by any chance?
Not at the moment. We did just finish sort of a big run through of the reader-submitted errata.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is my sort of first time through this particular dance, but I think that's going to end up translating out into like an update to the ebooks that people have purchased through O'Reilly, and maybe a refresh on certain print editions somewhere. I'm not quite sure how that percolates through. But the thing about Clojure is that it's actually, there have been very significant changes in implementation details to make the language and its runtime library more efficient, but very, very few language changes between the version that the book targets, which is a minimum of 1.3, and 1.6 was just released
yep.
a couple weeks ago. This is totally my opinion, but I actually wouldn't make any substantial changes to the language portion of the book now compared to what we wrote back then. There have been a couple of feature additions like tagged reader literals and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Core async, that's new. Right?
Yeah, but that's technically not a language. I mean, it's
a library.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it apparently it was slated to be an addition to the language, but it was discovered that because of the macro system, it ends up not having to be part of language, which is pretty cool in and
for
of
sure.
itself.
Totally.
So that actually wouldn't have any bearing on the language side of the book. The couple of things that would be left out for the audience that the book is targeting, which is people coming from Java, Python, and Ruby,
mm-hmm.
Reducers and the tagged reader literals are the two big feature additions between 1.3 and 1.6 that the book doesn't cover.
Mm.
And reducers absolutely have value, and you should sort of know about them by the time you get to be reasonably proficient with the language. It's good to know that they exist.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with reader literals. You'll come across them through the natural course of using newer versions of Clojure.
Mm.
But in neither case are they sort of essential to understanding the core idioms of the language and how to go about building and understanding Clojure code. And actually, in the case of both, they're not, how to use them well is actually not well known necessarily by many.
Mm-hmm.
They're very esoteric corners of the language that require a lot of sort of good taste to use. And personally, I'm not quite sure I even have a handle on it. So I wouldn't put in a book meant for sort of advanced intermediate people coming in from other languages.
Yeah.
The library and tools part of the book could use an update, but that's sort of the nature of adding in tools and library bits into a book like this.
Sure, of course.
And so it's a question of, you know, when O'Reilly wants to pull the trigger on that.
Mm.
And
It's interesting, though, to me. I saw a guideline somewhere when you're contributing code to Clojure or Clojure contrib or something. It says, you know, most important, get the name and the arguments correct, or the name and the signature correct of the function. You know, what it takes and what it returns, and then you can, you know, refactor the internals as much as you want without breaking other people's code.
Sure.
And it sounds like Clojure has achieved that pretty well.
Yeah. So I mean, so there are programs that were written for, you know, pre-Clojure 1.0 from 5 years ago that still work and work as intended. So mm-hmm. one of the only example of this I know sort of off the top of my head is the Ants demo that Rich Hickey put together and actually demonstrated for the first time at the Western Mass Developers Group like 5.5 years ago, maybe, or something like that.
Mm.
It's a Java 2D demonstration of a simulation of ants running around sort of a game field that has, you know, like a home base for the ants and then little food pods. And each ant is represented by a ref, which is one of Clojure's reference values that has a certain set of semantics for its concurrency and change semantics.
Mm-hmm.
And that demo, which was written, 5 years ago, still works on the most recent version of Clojure. So it's had a sort of compatibility, forwards and backwards compatibility is a big virtue in the Clojure space and sort of exemplified by language.
Mm-hmm. So you do a lot of open source work too in Clojure and Clojure Script. Fair to say that you're a pretty big fan, it seems like.
Yeah, so I've been, aside from the PDF business, that's been my primary playground for probably 4.5 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly done other things here and there as needed, but it gives me a lot of flexibility and a reasonable set of performance characteristics, a good escape hatch to Java if I need to, and even to native libraries if I need to.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been working on the JVM in one form or another for almost 20 years. Good grief.
Yeah.
So it's a very comfortable environment.
Yeah. What can I ask you about your open source contributions? Do you want to talk? Do you have anything that you're excited about that you're gearing up on, or?
Well, so the Quilt stuff is all going to be open source, but that's the gearing up section.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the stuff that I do and that I'm known for is sort of very stable, and it's largely a matter of maintenance and helping people through issues and things like that. I sort of, through dint of circumstance, am maintaining a bunch of libraries and tools around Clojure Script, just because a couple of other contributors sort of fell off and got interested in other things.
Mm-hmm.
So LineCLJS build, I took over as steward of some months ago and have sort of cleaned it up here and there, and have some, I think, pretty reasonable changes that I'm going to be pushing through for a version 2. One thing that I have been very pleased about is the testing story around Clojure Script. So I ported Clojure Test, which is the unit test, quote unquote, framework. It's really just a very small library with one or two macros from Clojure to Clojure Script. And just recently, maybe a month ago or so, added async support to that so that you can test code that is portable between Clojure and Clojure Script in an asynchronous way in both environments. And that includes using core async or JavaScript futures and Clojure futures on the JVM side. And so there's a lot of interesting things around the testing story.
Hmm.
But yeah, otherwise, I have a bunch of libraries and tools out there that are sort of in maintenance mode, but for good reasons.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So a little bit earlier, you mentioned workaholism.
Yeah.
And how it had been detrimental to you in the past.
Yeah.
What did that look like?
Oh man, this is a Barbara Walters like weeping on the couch kind of thing now.
I don't think we've had any weeping on the podcast yet. So,
so the real workaholism issue cropped up when I was in the process of failing badly with the first iteration of Snowtide. This is like circa 2000, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just burning every possible end of every candle I had. Mm-hmm. Probably, how many hours are in the week? I don't know. I'm not so good with arithmetic while I'm yakking, but you know, 80 plus hours a week, and I sort of don't remember a whole lot about that period in my life aside from working. That wasn't healthy for me. I gained I gained probably 70 pounds.
Wow.
I got up to 265, 270. Wasn't great for my family. The woman who is now my wife, we had moved in together, but I was neglecting her, something fierce.
Mm-hmm.
And she was coping with it somehow. So I mean, things ended up working out okay in the end, but it was a pretty dark time and wasn't good for anybody and had a horrible outcome to boot. And so something I hopefully a lesson that I only had to learn once, just because I mean now I still work a lot, up at 4:30 or 5, and I usually go a full 12 hours with like a break for lunch and exercise in between, and or doing other things like helping out my mom or whatever. But aside from that, I'm still working a lot, but it's sort of a there's a cadence to it, and it's a marathon I can run for the long haul, as opposed to this constant sprint mentality that I should have had this stuff done yesterday kind of thing.
Yeah. Were there other people involved in this during this time, this first business, or was it just you?
No, I had employees, which is part of what accounts for the $140,000 misery.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And an office and all sorts of really stupid things, or stupid given my level of capitalization, which was to say none.
Right. Or so, negative.
Or negative. Right. Yeah. There were other employees. It wasn't wise, smart in any way. And my girlfriend at the time and my family said, maybe this isn't quite right, which I just sort of poo-pooed as, family being family or whatever. But I also had, I had a lawyer and an accountant and other sort of professional contacts, and nobody said, hey, this doesn't look right.
Yeah.
Just because, their interests weren't necessarily aligned with my interests, and so that's sort of a regret that I didn't have any sort of independent third parties that could provide that sort of feedback and, raise the warning flags and say, this isn't going in a good place. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. You and I were talking a little bit earlier about podcasts, and you were saying, I get a little bingy with podcasts. Sure. And also other things.
Sure.
So is your personality seem to be a little bit wired that way? Towards, I guess, intensity or sort of like a lot of stuff.
Yeah. It's always, not to totally doing a disservice to people who actually have a diagnosed condition, but I'm sort of naturally OCD.
Mm-hmm.
When I have something in my teeth, then that's what I'm working on. Heaven forfend somebody suggests I do something other because the blinders go up because I'm heading in that direction. That's my natural tendency.
Yep.
Which lends itself very well to doing programming.
Yeah,
right?
Totally. I was just
because
thinking
you have to, or any kind of analytical task, mm-hmm. where you have this set amount of work and you know what the end state looks like that you want to get to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a matter of doing the work and grinding it out to some extent, and a lot of cases with most of the problems that we have to work with. And so a lot of the work that I've been doing sort of on a personal level has been trying to be mindful about that impulse and making sure that I have the perspective necessary to sort of pull back and know when I should stop and think and look for a better solution, perhaps, or say, the outcome is not correlated with the amount of work that I'm putting into it, right? I'm not going to get back my investment on this particular obsession.
Mm-hmm.
So
you clearly a big fan of closure. Do you have any other favorite languages?
I've always been fascinated with concatenative languages. So Factor being the most recent popular example there, Forth obviously being the granddaddy of those. I really enjoy working in C when I can.
What does it mean for a language to be concatenative?
You're asking something that probably has a very precise answer. I'm going to give a very hand-wavy, imprecise, incorrect answer. But where the primary operation is to operate over a stack, which generally means concatenating items onto the stack or popping items off through an application of a function to that stack, which pulls its arguments from it and then pushes its result back onto it. And so there's a number of ways in which concatenative languages can be used to implement a variety of algorithms very efficiently. And also you can target concatenative languages to a number of different architectures very efficiently. So it compiles nicely down into assembly or to JVM bytecode or on and on and on, just because the model lends itself very nicely to the von Neumann architecture, essentially. Or that's my rough understanding, having implemented AF4th or whatever.
What's the von Neumann architecture?
Von Neumann. That's the infinite paper tape with a read and a write operation. And so that's the von Neumann architecture, as opposed to the lambda calculus from the Church theorem. Those are the two sort of competing, not competing, two sides of the same coin characterizations of computation that exist. I think there's another one in a very elevated intellectual space that has to do with uncomputable values. So if a particular computation will not terminate or sort of NP complete or whatever, you can postulate that there is an oracle that will provide that value in bounded space and time. And if you presume that, then a lot of algorithms that are otherwise unimplementable become implementable. So it's a very rarefied space of computation where I think some principles apply that don't apply in lambda calculus or von Neumann architecture. But that's all from me reading a couple of papers that I barely understood.
Yeah, I was just thinking I'd have Tom Stewart on. He's the author of Understanding Computation.
I'm sure he would have way more to say about this than I. I'm a dilettante when it comes to reading papers that are far beyond my means.
Mm, cool. So yeah, factor and fourth, fan of those.
Yeah,
you do a little bit of C.
I always enjoy dabbling in C just because of the sort of raw, dangerous power that it gives you. I've had to do C and C++ stuff for building executables that sort of do something and then bootstrap a JVM on top of it and then provide a nice bridge to certain libraries in ways that like JNI or JNA, which are two APIs for accessing native libraries from the Java side, don't provide. Other languages, I did a dangerous stint in VimScript like 6 months ago when I was trying to stack asynchronous evaluation on top of it. It ended up basically working, except if I was using Mac Vim, it would segfault. But if I was using Vim on the command line, it was fine. So it was actually some critical section in the Cocoa bindings, I think, is what was actually getting hosed by my asynchronous touching of the Vim APIs, what I was actually doing.
What was the goal there?
The goal there was to allow for asynchronous evaluation within Vim Fireplace of expressions being sent to a remote closure REPL. So if you perform an evaluation in Vim Fireplace, the Vim environment is locked up until it gets the result back.
Okay.
And so that doesn't work for me. I want to send off an expression and have that running while I'm doing other things, or maybe, heaven forfend, I have two different processes that need to communicate, and part of the testing and development involves like REPLing on both sides. This is something that you should be able to do reasonably in a development environment, as far as I'm concerned. And so I wanted that, and I sort of had gotten the Vim religion in terms of the way that it manipulates text and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the runtime was not keeping up in terms of my closure development and workflow.
Mm.
This is sort of harkens back to our conversation about me being too single-minded. I started hacking away at VimScript in order to get this working the way I wanted it to instead of backing up. So eventually I backed up, and now I use Evil with an Emacs. Mm. So I have maybe the best of both worlds in terms of manipulation capabilities from Evil. And then, Emacs has a very reasonable runtime that provides sort of that asynchronous evaluation of things.
Mm-hmm. I remember seeing from the survey you did of the closure community that Emacs was the leading editor.
Yeah, it sort of wins by default to a certain extent, mm-hmm. just because of the Lisp heritage that feeds into it, as well as sort of the resurgence of Emacs, even outside of Clojure and other Lisps. It's used pretty widely in the Ruby community, as far as I know. Yeah, it sort of gets the win by default, although there's tons of development environments that have sort of enough critical mass that you can reasonably depend on them for Eclipse and IntelliJ and Vim. There's TextMate and there's all Subtext and all the different editors. They all have very reasonable closure bindings or plugins or whatever the local idiom is.
Yeah, I am a bit bummed though as a Vim user to hear you weren't successful with this.
Plenty of people use Vim and are very happy with it. I just happen to be working on network services, and so I'd have two different processes hooked up that are talking to each other, or I want end processes ultimately, and I want to be able to send expressions to both and not necessarily have my editor block if I have a bug in one, for example, that causes the expression that I evaluate not to respond, right? I want to be able to have that come back in 10 seconds or 20 or 5 hours. Shouldn't matter. And so there's this is a widely recognized issue with the runtime. I mean, the editing system is sort of unparalleled, right?
Yeah.
But the runtime has its issues. And so there's a guy that's often forked it and is working on making the runtime more modern. I'm sure there's a variety of other issues that it has from an architectural standpoint.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I'm looking forward to seeing if that pans out at all, though. I sort of feel for Bram Molinar, is the lead developer of Vim. He's put a lot of work into Vim. I mean, nothing compared to a lot of people that say, you know, I do open source work. He's in there for decades. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long.
Yeah, I think so.
And so it's always a bummer to have someone come along and fork and try and go in a totally different direction. But hopefully there will be a reconciliation if the fork is actually productive in the way that it hopes to be, I guess.
Fingers crossed. Anything I haven't asked you about that you want to talk about?
Nothing off the top of my head. We sort of opened up with the big thing that I've been whacking away at for quite a while, so I don't have any new news to spill.
Okay. So if people want to hear more about that, or if they want to be on the list, they can go drop their email in the box.
Quilt.org, and hopefully do a little good for the way data and computation are represented and performed.
Hmm. And we've had 90-something podcasts now. I'm pretty sure you're the first person to say heaven for Fend.
Cool.
And you said it twice.
I hope there's proper analytics. I hope someone does like a word cramp thing or word cloud thing and shows up all my different speaking idioms.
I like it. The first thing we need is a service that extracts words from a stream of audio.
Right.
We'll call it PDF audio text. MP3 text stream.
Extraction. Stream.
MP3 text stream.
Yeah, there you go. I think Google has a solution for you.
You might be right.
I'm guessing they'll probably miss heaven for friend.
Yeah, could be.
With the automatic translation.
Who knows what that is going to come at us.
Three times now.
Well, thanks for coming by. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it.
It's good to talk to you.
It was great.
Awesome. If you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to thoughtbot.com/giantrobots/95. Thanks for listening.